Ukraine war.
Yemeni health officials say 19 million Yemenis lack access to health care. They say it is a shame for the international community to abandon Yemeni women and the children who have been paying the highest price since the beginning of the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Yet another wave of COVID-19 is hitting South Korea, with cases doubling to 40,000 per day in the past week. The BA5 Omicron subvariant accounts for almost a third of the new cases, a portion that is increasing. While experts recognize vaccines may not always prevent infection, they decrease illnesses and deaths.
Even people who have been infected with Omicron before are not able to develop enough immunity to this variant unless they are vaccinated. People who have been fully vaccinated and boosted but become infected have reduced chances of severe illness of 70 to 90%.
The fatality rate of COVID-19 has dropped to near the seasonal flu. Still, experts argue that changed behaviors of mask wearing and routine vaccinations should remain in place. The recent spike in COVID-19 cases here comes as South Korea Thursday detects the first case of BA2.75, nicknamed Centaurus. Scientists worry this highly mutated Omicron variant is even more transmissible than previous strains. Some want stronger antivirus enforcement, suggesting public apathy risks another COVID-induced economic downturn.
I know that more than 90% of corona can be prevented by wearing a mask, but if people keep coming inside and taking off their masks, I feel like it will be impossible to stop the spread. So the government should take stronger measures in that area.
People are required to wear masks on transit, but the government has said it will not implement lockdowns. People over 50 will be offered fourth vaccinations next week. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Every year in the lunar month of Dhul Hijjah, Muslims celebrate Eid al-Ghadir, a major festivity on the Islamic calendar, marking the day when Prophet Muhammad appointed Ali ibn Abi Talib, the first Shia imam, as his successor, and Muslims' next leader some 14 centuries ago. In Iran's city of Mashhad, the shrine of Imam Reza has been hosting pilgrims who have come days ahead of the auspicious occasion to celebrate the festivity.
Happy Eid al-Ghadir to all fellow Muslims. I come from Iraq to participate in the celebrations here in Mashhad. Eid al-Ghadir marks the day when Prophet Muhammad announced to Muslims that Imam Ali is the next Muslim leader. He raised Imam Ali's hand and said, "Whoever I am their leader, Ali is their leader too." The Prophet was on his way back from his last Hajj pilgrimage, where he was accompanied by many people.
Eid al-Ghadir comes 8 days after another major festivity on the Islamic lunar calendar, dubbed Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. The occasion marks the climax of the annual Hajj pilgrimage.
To us Iranians, it's a blessing to visit the shrine of Imam Reza on the Feast of Sacrifice and other festivities. Those of us who can't make it to Mecca on the Hajj usually come to Imam Reza's shrine to pray and enjoy the spiritual atmosphere.
Imam Reza is the 8th Shia Imam, whose bloodline goes back to the Prophet of Islam. He holds a special position among Iranians since he spent his last years of life in Iran, away from his birthplace in modern-day Saudi Arabia. Every year, his holy shrine hosts millions of pilgrims from around the Muslim world, especially during religious occasions. Iranians never miss a chance to come and visit the shrine of Imam Reza. And now that Eid al-Ghadir is just around the corner, Shia Muslims find it an opportunity to once again attend this holy site and share the festive mood with each other. Yusuf Jalali from the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad.
Notorious Ukrainian website Mirot Veretz, meaning peacemaker. It publishes the names and addresses of those it deems to be enemies of Ukraine. The opening page shows pictures of dead Russian soldiers. On the list are domestic and foreign journalists, politicians, and citizens that in some way they view to have aided or worked with pro-Russian forces in the country. Now, shamefully, they are adding children to the list. Faina Sevenkova, she is 13 years old and has been writing about her experiences here in Donbass. After her name appeared on the list, she started to receive threats of physical violence online.
Are you worried about being on the website? Are you concerned that something might happen to you?
Yes, of course. A person I knew got to know my address and came to greet me for my birthday. These are good intentions, but something worse can happen. Websites like this shouldn't exist. They're illegal. They put many people in danger, children as well. I have a friend who was put on there because she wrote a poem about war.
Numerous journalists and public figures have been murdered after being put on the list, like Oles Bazina, who was shot near his home in Kiev, and Andrea Rocelli, an Italian journalist. After he was killed on the front line, the website posted liquidated over his photo. The Committee to Protect Journalists has previously written to the Ukrainian government asking them to condemn the unfounded and damaging allegations published on Mira Tervets and to clarify publicly that the Ukrainian Interior Ministry is dedicated to protecting journalists. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch have also condemned the site. Dianis Bitkonen, a Finnish journalist in Donbass, he's also on the list.
It's all against all international laws, and you shouldn't have right, any country shouldn't have a right to do that kind of like hunting list, kill lists of people and put it to the public, especially. It's a very brutal way how to cause people serious problems, and many have lost their lives because of being on that list.
The website clearly states it provides information for law enforcement authorities and special services. Ukrainian government ministers have praised the site, and it is actively used by the authorities to track and detain enemies of the state.
While Western media and governments try to whitewash the extremist or far-right neo-Nazi elements here in Ukraine, calling it Russian propaganda, for a website promoted, supported and used by the government that openly encourages violence towards children is a clear indication that Ukraine does have a serious problem with state-sponsored extremism. They're basically encouraging people to kill people on the list?
Yeah. That's why I've been in since 2015. I certainly cannot fall to the Ukrainian hands because I am on that list with several pages even. But like the old saying is that the other's one's terrorist is another other one's freedom fighter, and hopefully all sense and truth and peace-loving people understand that all these people in that list are heroes.
To openly encourage violence towards children takes a special kind of evil, an evil that NATO countries, as they continue to pump Ukraine with money, weapons and political support, seem unwilling or incapable to challenge. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
The EU's tourism industry is currently thriving, but make no mistake, businesses facing huge overheads are struggling to turn a profit. In its summer economic forecast, the European Commission has revised growth downwards and inflation upwards. The bloc is concerned Russia is going to turn off all its gas supplies.
This risk has become more than just a hypothetical scenario for which we need to prepare. So a storm is possible.
For millions, the storm is already here. Governments are accused of not providing support to deal with the cost of living crisis arising from sanctions against Russia, but can find money for other causes. The EU is providing 9 billion euro to Ukraine to run the country and has sent a separate 2 billion for military equipment. This is in addition to the huge amounts of money being spent on Ukraine by individual member states, most of whom are in NATO, where military spending is also increasing. Not to mention the EU is developing its own army. Citizens say fueling the Ukraine war is costing the EU too much.
It's time to be talking about peace, not about weapons or providing more financial aid to the war.
If the parties could come together and agree a peace, that would be wonderful. But, you know, I'm not sure that's happening, right?
Yes, of course we need to end the war, but the problem is nobody knows how to end the war, you know.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, has been facing pressure during a visit to the European Parliament.
NATO, along with the US and the EU, were never a defensive mechanism, not before the war and not after it. They are offensive. Ukraine has been sacrificed for their interests.
Experts warn the growing social crisis in the EU will have dire consequences for the political establishment. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have condemned U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to occupied Palestine. Scores of people in the blockaded enclave protested against Biden's visit while shouting slogans in support of resistance actions against the occupying regime. U.S. President Joe Biden arrived in Tel Aviv on Wednesday to kick off his first trip to the region since taking office. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas accused Joe Biden of putting the interests of the Israeli regime ahead of the legitimate rights of Palestinians and regional security.
The President of the United States of America carries nothing but unlimited support for the Zionist entity, its security and prosperity, and a package of false promises to the Palestinians. The United States' adoption of Zionist plans is based on uprooting our people from their land by force and obliterating their identity and history in favor of the Zionist entity.
During his trip to the occupied territories, Joe Biden visited U.S.-funded missile interception systems, including the so-called Iron Dome and Iron Beam. The Islamic Jihad movement says the U.S. administration only aims to prolong the Israeli occupation and support its aggression against the Palestinian people.
Joe Biden's visit comes to serve the interests of the Zionist entity, and he's not welcomed in our land. We believe that the U.S. and the Zionist regime share the same interests. Joe Biden has ignored the suffering of the Palestinian people and continues to support the Zionist regime.
Palestinians have warned against the dangers of Biden's agenda and the attempts to integrate the Israeli regime into the region and expand the circle of normalization with it. Analysts say that all U.S. administrations have adopted the same biased policy towards the Israeli regime.
When it comes to Israel and Israeli security, there is no difference at all between Republicans and Democrats. What we are witnessing today is that Democratic President Joe Biden's support for the deal of the century and his support for further normalization between Israel and the Arab countries.
Palestinians are calling on the free people of the world to reject the arrogance and policies of the United States that target the region's security and stability.
Observers say that Joe Biden's visit will only give the Israeli regime the green light to further violate the rights of the Palestinian people. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., a day after the West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin scuttled plans to pass a climate and tax package, many in his party blamed him for the demise of their ambitions and expressed a lack of trust in him. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Emily Cochrane, Katie Edmondson, and Stephanie Lai. The piece is titled, Manchin Dangles Hopes of a Future Compromise, Democrats Revolt. Please stay with us for more. It was a familiar, if excruciating, position for Democrats. A day after pulling the plug on his party's plans to pass a climate, energy and tax package this summer, Senator Joe Manchin III of West Virginia, the conservative-leaning Democrat who has repeatedly flirted with compromise only to scuttle his party's highest ambitions, called in on Friday to a West Virginia radio show. Perhaps, he suggested, in another month or so, he might see his way clear to salvaging the last bits of President Joe Biden's domestic agenda. There was no guarantee, of course, and the comments were only the latest instance of Joe Manchin capitalizing on his role as a swing vote in an evenly divided Senate to dictate his party's legislative strategy, leaving Democrats at his mercy. This time, though, Democrats had had enough. Rather than engage in another round of will-he-or-won't-he negotiations with Mr. Manchin, President Biden let it be known that he was done trying to secure his climate agenda in Congress. Joe Manchin's abrupt withdrawal left Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York and a majority leader, jilted after months of courting a colleague whose demands and red lines seemed to shift by the day, or the latest economic projection. And it prodded many Democrats into open revolt against Mr. Manchin, blaming him for the demise of their ambitions and the last chance for their party to tackle the existential threat of climate change. Joe Manchin, said Representative Pramila Jayapal of Washington, the chairwoman of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, has shown that he doesn't know how to close a deal, or he doesn't want to close a deal, and that you can't trust him. For more than a year, Joe Manchin, who at 74 is serving his third term in the Senate, has been situated exactly where he prefers to be, at the center of the high-stakes political and policy negotiation, with attention and speculation focused on him. Democrats have toiled to win his vote on any piece of their once ambitious domestic agenda, tailoring their policy moves so as not to alienate him. They have contorted themselves to suit his often changing dictates and have scaled back their ambitions repeatedly to stay within his red lines. But they have so far come away empty-handed on their biggest priorities. Because of Democrats' razor-thin margin of control in the 50-50 Senate and unified Republican opposition to most of their agenda, Joe Manchin has effective veto power over the party's legislative strategy and has exercised it often and unapologetically. But while President Biden and congressional Democrats have pushed for transformative policies to confront generational challenges such as climate change, Joe Manchin, who channels the desires of his very conservative coal and gas producing state, has focused on nearer term issues. On Friday, he said he had told party leaders he wanted to wait another month until inflation numbers for July were released, before he could decide on whether to act on climate change. "I am where I have been. I would not put my staff through this. I would not put myself through this if I wasn't sincere about trying to find a pathway forward to do something that's good for our country," Joe Manchin said on Friday in the interview with the radio host Hoppy Kershaval. "They cannot come to grips because I have a D by my name, or someone has an R by their name. We should do whatever one side wants. That's not me." President Biden made no mention of Joe Manchin in a statement issued on Friday, asked at a news conference in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, whether the West Virginian senator had been negotiating in good faith. The president demurred, saying he was not the one who had been negotiating with him. But angry congressional Democrats pinned their frustration on the West Virginia Democrat. One senator, Martin Heinrich of New Mexico, mused publicly about whether Joe Manchin deserved his chairmanship of the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources. "It's been a really, really terrible day," Senator Tina Smith, Democrat of Minnesota and a key champion of climate provisions, said in an interview. "If Senator Manchin wants a deal on climate and energy, he can have one in a heartbeat. This is Senator Manchin's deal for the taking, and if it doesn't happen, it is on him." On Capitol Hill, Joe Manchin is something of a unicorn, the only national Democrat from his ruby-red state, and acts and votes accordingly. Set to face voters in 2024, he is unlikely to be threatened by a primary challenger in a state former President Donald Trump won by nearly 40 percentage points in 2020. That has given Mr. Manchin leverage to accomplish his own policy goals, including holding firm against moving entirely away from oil and gas, and resist what he considers his party's lurch towards its liberal base. He appears happiest when he is in the middle of a consequential policy negotiation. He has been wined and dined as a crucial participant in bipartisan talks, invited to President Biden's Wilmington home for breakfast, and pursued by the White House officials, lawmakers, aides and reporters who dissect his every syllable for a kernel of insight. But the murkiness and at times inconsistency of Joe Manchin's positions has increasingly grated on his Democratic colleagues. Barely 3 months into the Biden administration, he prompted the longest open vote in modern Senate history by raising a last-minute objection to the size of unemployment benefits in the $1.9 trillion pandemic aid plan. Democrats had to slash the jobless payments to win his vote, which cemented passage of the package. He refused to help Democrats change filibuster rules to enact voting rights legislation, killing the effort even after Chuck Schumer gave him the lead role in writing an alternative bill to ensure he would support it. But on no issue has Joe Manchin bedeviled Democrats more than on their ambitious social safety net, climate and tax package. To win his vote to begin work on the plan, Chuck Schumer signed on to a secret memo with Mr. Manchin that made clear that the West Virginian senator had no intention of accepting the $3.5 trillion in spending envisioned in Democrats' budget. The document outlined Joe Manchin's much narrower parameters for a $1.5 trillion package, including income thresholds for social programs and accommodations for fossil fuel tax credits and natural gas. "I will try to dissuade Joe on many of these," Chuck Schumer scrawled on the document, which enraged many Democrats when it became public. He never could. 6 months later, Joe Manchin abruptly walked away from talks on the package. Democrats regrouped in January and began efforts to rebuild their shattered plan, adhering strictly to the components that Joe Manchin had repeatedly laid out: paying down the national debt, overhauling parts of the tax code, and lowering the cost of prescription drugs by allowing Medicare to negotiate prices and some spending. By earlier this month, Senate Democrats had begun rolling out pieces of a package they believed could win Joe Manchin's support, including a drug pricing proposal and a plan to shore up the solvency of a key Medicare program by increasing taxes for some high-earning Americans. But by Thursday evening, 14th of July, after news that prices had surged 9.1% in the year ending in June, Joe Manchin balked again, telling Chuck Schumer that he wanted to wait on any climate or tax proposals until seeing inflation figures for the month of July. Should Democrats insist on pushing forward with legislative action before then, Joe Manchin said, they should act only on proposals aimed at lowering the cost of prescription drugs and extending expanded Affordable Care Act subsidies. "Let's wait until that comes out so we know what we're going down the path. It won't be inflammatory to add more to inflation," Joe Manchin said in the radio interview. Recounting Chuck Schumer's response, Joe Manchin added, "I said, Chuck, it's wrong. It's not prudent to do the other right now. I want climate, I want an energy policy," he said, adding, "I thought we were moving truly in the right direction." But Chuck Schumer appeared to have grown exasperated and convinced that Joe Manchin's vote was not obtainable. One official said that Joe Manchin had rebuffed major concessions that would have enraged progressive Democrats, including adding more drilling measures, removing a key electric vehicle tax credit, and dropping tax increases he had resisted. Mr. Manchin's stance effectively scuttled the chances of action in the coming days and a critical priority for Democrats, and strongly suggested that unless they abandon the climate and tax proposals altogether, they might not salvage any of their domestic policy package before the midterm congressional elections in November. In September, after a five-week planned recess, lawmakers will have only a limited window to act on the package, and they're eager to give themselves as much time as possible to campaign on whatever they pass before the November elections. Bearing political scars from a year of fractious talks, few Democrats on Friday, 15th of July, seemed willing to gamble that there was a larger deal to be had in September.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
I'm Kavit Ahlai. The war in Ukraine is moving full steam ahead. One of the developments, energy warnings from the IEA, the International Energy Agency, who has said that a potentially disastrous natural gas supply crunch this winter awaits Europe due to the possibility of Russia cutting off gas supplies completely. Then there's a warning from the former Russian President Medvedev that an attack on Crimea will ignite, quote, Judgment Day response. Meanwhile, several high-profile suspensions have taken place in Ukraine, while Russia is targeting Ukraine's missiles as Western-supplied weapons bite. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Journalist and political commentator Fred Weir joins us from Moscow. Then we have the president of the European Institute for International Law and International Relations, Mahmoud Rafat, who joins us from Stockholm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you. The former Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, has issued a warning that I thought would set the stage for this program, in which he said, attack on Crimea will ignite, quote, Judgment Day response. Judgment Day will come very hard, very fast and hard. It will be very difficult to hide. Tell us, give us context of that and what he's talking about, what he means.
Well, I think the key here is the American threat to provide long-range missiles. They're providing these multiple launch missiles, you know, the HIMARS they're called, with shorter ranges, like 30 to up to 70 kilometers. But there is a version of this weapon system that has missiles that go up to 300 kilometers. And the Ukrainians have explicitly threatened to use them against Crimea. And there, Crimea is, besides its symbolic importance to Ukraine, it is a target-rich environment. It has the Russian naval base at Sevastopol and several key military zones. So I think this threat is something the Russians take pretty seriously. And I'm guessing that warning is directed, not directly, but symbolically at Washington. They're trying to tell the Americans, don't supply this type of weaponry to the Ukrainians because it will be a major escalation. Otherwise, I don't know what Judgment Day might mean. I mean, the Russians do have the ability to destroy a lot of targets inside Ukraine, and they do, they are doing it. So, but Judgment Day is a religious term, and I don't really know what specific sort of escalation they're threatening. But it doesn't, it sounds chilling, that's for sure.
Mahmoud Rafat, I'll put this into context as to how some have been reporting this, in which Medvedev was said not to elaborate, but has previously warned the U.S., they've put it in this context, of the dangers of attempting to punish a nuclear power like Russia over its action in Ukraine. Do you think that the U.S. is pushing Russia's buttons to that point?
Well, obviously, the American side gave intelligence information about the places of Russian generals, which caused killing 17 generals, and this started by direct orders or instructions from President Biden, which means, yes, there are somehow Americans pushing both Ukraine and Europeans against Russia, and not in a Russian way, because we have to also remember there is international law, and this international law gives Ukraine the right to the to join the NATO, but on the ground that not feasible, especially for the Russian side, which they consider a big threat to them, to the security, national security of Russia. And they would never admit it. So not only the international law will manage the case or the file in front of us today, but will be somehow powers who will talk in the next few weeks. And we will see the escalation will arrive until which point if the American side continues supporting Kiev.
Well, not to just zoom in on this issue, but I think it's pretty important since we have opened up the program with it. And Fred Weir, I'm curious whether the U.S. has to discuss or get permission from other NATO members when it wants to, when it provides Ukraine with this HIMARS, what do you call it, a HIMARS missile system? Is that what it's called? Where it, as you said, has a 300-kilometer range? Because based on that, my next question then would be, what if one lands in Crimea, or two, or how many would it take for Russia to react? This is for Fred Weir. Go ahead, Fred Weir. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The HIMARS system, it is one system, but it has different types of ammunition. They are already providing, I mean, the Americans are already providing these systems to Ukraine. They're already in action in the Donbass. Apparently, there are a dozen or so of them already in Ukraine. But that type of ammunition, which is the high-end, the long-range missiles, are not yet being provided. And it would be, I think it would be a step beyond for the Americans to do so, except that we've already had this exchange of opinions. The Ukrainians have said, we will target Crimea, which we consider to be Ukrainian territory, not Russian. And the United States, officially, I haven't got the quote to hand, but they did officially say that they wouldn't consider Crimea to be Russian territory because they have forbidden the Ukrainians to use these weapons against Russian territory. But both the United States and Ukraine doesn't consider Crimea Russian territory. Therefore, I think some sort of fix is in, and that in Washington they are contemplating this very escalation. And it would be pretty serious, as that quote, that rather obscure, vague quote from Medvedev clearly implies. The Russians would regard that as a serious escalation, and they would react in some way. And we don't know what that would be, but, you know, everything like this draws us a little closer to World War III than we would like to be.
Sure. Well, Mr. Rafat, on the political side, within Ukraine, there was a development that was pretty strange in the way it was first presented and then retracted, in a sense, where President Volodymyr Zelensky was reported first abruptly firing the head of Ukraine's powerful domestic security agency called the SBU, then the state prosecutor general, in which it cited dozens of cases actually of collaboration with Russia by officials in those agencies. But then the news came out that they have been suspended pending investigations, not formally dismissed. What do you make of that development?
Well, I think there is somehow a contradiction in the behavior of President Zelensky, because he fired the top officials of intelligence and the prosecutor as well, general prosecutor of Ukraine, because he accused them, or he said their employees are working for the Russian, which is considered enemy of Ukraine for the moment. While that cannot be applied on the ground, that cannot be imagined on the ground to happen, because these people, either they were blocked there or they were imprisoned or whatever we call their statute, but not working for Russian side. This is not imaginable even to work for the Russian side. But in my opinion, President Zelensky expected more investigation or more result of the war crimes and crimes against humanity, etc., of these chains of crimes the Kiev prosecution addressed to the Russian side. And both the intelligence service with the prosecution did not fulfill his wishes to gather as much as he wanted to present them to the International Criminal Court or to start with other Western governments this case, the case of crimes, war crimes, and crimes against humanity they accuse Russia to had committed. In my opinion, this is the main reason, the failure of the two structures or two organizations to fulfill the wishes of President Zelensky in these cases.
How do you see that, Fred? I mean, some are looking at this being maybe on a larger scale to happen, because as the war drags on, as the country is suffering as immensely as it is, that you're going to see more dissent, maybe in a sense, to happen in Ukraine. Do you see this as a sign of that?
I think it's a very worrisome.
No, this is Fred Weir. Go ahead, Fred Weir. I'm sorry.
It's extremely worrisome. It's not just the two top officials who've been suspended. They haven't been accused of treason. But there are ongoing almost 700 treason cases in Ukraine. And this something Zelensky mentioned in his statement. There's 660 cases of treason within the state apparatus, the SBU, the military, other institutions. And there are 60 cases of officials in occupied territories who have gone to work for the Russians. This is totally believable, by the way. And I don't know about all the treason cases and so on, but you have a regime that is now clearly terrified of its own shadow. This scale of arrests and treason charges is not a sign of a unified government in any way. So it's extremely worrisome, and it's the kind of thing that starts to get out of hand when you've got that many people clearly being suspected of treason and on trial under arrest, and you've got police, secret police and others looking for such enemies. This kind of thing has a way of snowballing. It is really, really worrisome. I have no idea what is going on in Kyiv, but people should be paying much closer attention to it.
Well, there's another point of concern for Ukraine, Masoud Rafat, and that is whether it's going to continue getting the support that it has been. And I'm going to put these two developments into one, forge it into one for you, where there's one piece of news that talks about what it termed EU fatigue, where the EU foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell actually had to make a statement saying some European leaders have been saying that the sanctions were an error, they were a mistake, in which he says we don't think it was a mistake. And then you have the get-together of the foreign ministers just today to show that the bloc can maintain its financial and military support, pledging more support for Ukraine. Of course, this is as their own citizens are suffering. Do you think that there's fatigue within the EU countries for prolonging this war?
Well, for sure, there's a fatigue. We can note now the exchange rate of the euro for the first time in its history to fall down in front of the dollar and to lose net percentage of its value and to become less than even $1 today after it was like $1.20. This is a big sign of fatigue of the economy as well. We mustn't forget the most important point that the industry of Europe is really threatened and seriously threatened because of the suspension of the Russian gas. Meanwhile, Russia is a big market for the European product. So there are on several levels. But we need to understand at the same time the kind of relation between Europe and the United States since the Second World War. Since the end of the Second World War, Europe did not build an army. Europe did not build real independency of the United States protection system. So when we talk about the NATO, we talk about United States decision. And it's very clear the administration of President Biden is insisting to continue the war with any price, to be from the European side or from the Russian side. And the Europeans will not be able to get out of this dilemma as long as the President Biden administration still, and we still have 3 years for this administration. So as long as the administration Biden is there, the war, I think, we will not be able to stop it despite the fatigue and despite the consequences Europe is paying. We are feeling today worldwide, maybe, but in Europe in particular, the dramatic increase of prices, the threat of industries, as I just mentioned, to be stopped because of the gas, lots of things we have in Europe. But Europe will not be able to dispatch from the United States decision because of the nature of the relationship since the end of the Second World War in 1945 until today, and will continue like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it remains to be seen how much of this relationship is going to continue in its bond. Because when you have a warning coming from the IAEA, for example, Fred Weir, where European nations, it said, must take urgent action to avert a potentially disastrous natural gas supply crunch. And the biggest one that I could think of, Fred Weir, is the one that was issued by Germany, where even the government said that, people have to maybe cope to turn to wood as a heating source for this winter. And plus, we know that Nord Stream 1 is actually under repair, where Russia now says, if we want to open it back up, we need to talk about lifting of sanctions. How worried should Europe be?
Yes, very worried. There are so many aspects of these sanctions that have boomeranged, but on the energy front, that is the biggest single, I don't know what you'd call it, goal or something that the West has inflicted. It is remarkable that in the meeting you referenced today, they did not impose any new energy-related sanctions. It is clear that the winter is not that far away, and natural gas reservoirs are not anywhere near full, and therefore this is a problem that is focusing minds for sure right now. I don't know what this leads to. What I fear, to come back to your original question, I fear further escalations, some news. You know how this happens? Some terrible thing happens, an atrocity, a huge war crime, something just comes up and completely changes the public atmosphere. And ratchets up the confrontation. This is a very dangerous time, and it's not a static thing, this Ukraine fatigue or whatever. I think we're in the midst of a very fluid situation, one in which the standoff between Russia and the West can turn very nasty very quickly. And So I don't know. I wake up every morning in sheer terror of what I might find when I start reading the news.
So what's going to trigger that? I mean, since you spoke that way, what would trigger that World War III scenario?
Yeah, well, the Ukrainians attacking Crimea with heavy missiles and the Russians retaliating in some way. Because what could the Russians do? They could retaliate against the NATO staging grounds where they're bringing weaponry into Ukraine, right on the border there. It seems likely that in recent attacks, the Russians have killed foreign officers. I don't think this is well noticed, but an attack on an officer's club in Vinnytsia the other day appears to have killed foreign military officers who were there consulting with their Ukrainian colleagues. This sort of thing, because NATO forces, especially Polish forces, are so much more involved in Ukraine and inside Ukraine, mm-hmm. And on the border where weapons are being transported every day, you can easily get an attack where Russians will hit NATO forces, and we will find ourselves in the midst of a hot war.
Sure. Well, since our guest there is from Stockholm, Sweden, I'd like to ask you, in terms of the application made by Sweden and Finland, and what your thoughts are about their desire and eagerness to join NATO.
Of Sweden, honestly, it's an old desire. Maybe it was pushed up by the war now between Russia and Ukraine, but this desire existed, and there were lots of voices calling to join NATO, but that was not really priority in Sweden. We know Sweden did not get involved in any war since more than 200 years, since 1814, did not get involved in any war. So despite that, Sweden was somehow motivated to go to the NATO since especially after the end of the Cold War, 1990 of last century. So this is all desire, but now I estimate it somehow came with rush. This step came with rush. Sweden would better to wait at least until the end of this year, because until today we do not know what is the limit of the escalation. Shall Russian side use a nuclear as threatened with, or it will limit its military action and military operation on what's running on the ground. Employing the pressures against a nuclear power must be managed differently, in my opinion. Russia is a nuclear power. You cannot put it under such pressure. So that's why we did not know the escalation will arrive to where. This right. is the point for the moment.
Well, final question goes to you, Fred Weir. This is what's worrying, to add to the sentiment that you have, when you have the Ukrainian foreign minister saying that the condition for peace talks with Moscow is, when it comes to having negotiations, it will only make sense only after Russia's defeat on the battlefield. Does he really understand what that means, defeating Russia on the battlefield, when he makes a statement like that?
Well, it does look increasingly phantasmagoric. The battlefield is gradually shaping up in Russia's favor. They're in the Donbass. They are grinding through the main Ukrainian army, step by step, town by town, trench by trench. And that is where most of the Ukrainian regular army is. They're heavily fortified, but they are getting defeated. And you can talk about future offensives and all kinds of Western weaponry that will be coming in. But basically, once Ukraine has lost its regular forces, it can't really replace them. So something right. has to break, and it probably will before the end of summer.
All right. Hot summer ahead of us. Fred Weir, Moscow, journalist and political commentator. Thank you. And thank you, Mahmoud Rafat, president at the European Institute for International Law and International Relations from Stockholm. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitavoy and the team, it's goodbye.